I do call this first meeting of the Capital Investment Committee to order. And we don't have no minutes since this is our first meeting, so we won't worry about that. We do have a quorum present, however. What we're going to do today is this. We'll be going around the room for introductions. We do have a couple of presentations that will be made, and that's pretty much what we're doing today. I want to make sure that everyone has had a chance to read the rules, committee rules that are before you. Do you have any questions? Yes.
This is actually a semi-serious question. On the final number 12.
Most important one, yes.
Yeah. Is there a time frame on the notification of such amendments to the rules? Notification?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Carlson?
No, Mr. Chairman, I have neither the agenda nor the rules.
Did you look in your packet?
Not in my packet, no. I just went through it. So it's kind of hard to read them without them being in the packet.
Well,
you and I, as both former teachers, you know how it is when you give a reading assignment, but you do have to have the book or the materials.
You know, I told Jeremiah not to give them to you, but he didn't realize I was just joking. In terms of seating.
Oh, I found them. I'm
see?
they were stuck to the capital investment on them, so. Jeremiah, I apologize.
We wouldn't slight you. In terms of seating, each day, you know, come on in, take your folder and your nameplate and sit wherever you want. There are no sides in capital investment. We try to be as nonpartisan or bipartisan as we can until we vote. But otherwise.
No, voting is even more important.
You know, yeah.
But otherwise, we do seriously try to be as fair as we can and as nonpartisan as we can. With that, I think I'll just, before we get into the introductions, give a brief introduction myself of where I expect us to be going here. Well, first of all, this is my gavel with wood from the Holy Land. My wife wanted me to point that out. For those that wonder why I might be limping around a little bit, it's because I had knee replacement surgery on November 11th. I do have my cane. I promise not to point it at people when I'm calling on them. Actually, I hope that I don't have that much longer. Now, the cane. Yeah, well, all right. So, capital investment, obviously, last year, the bonding bill failed to become law. And so we have various options for this year and for next. As I say, various options. We could do two large bills. We could do two small bills. We could do a small bill this year and a bigger bill next year. We could do a bigger bill this year and a smaller bill next year. It just depends. I can't tell you what option is going to be chosen because I really don't know. I don't think that's been fully decided yet. I will say to you that I think we should do a bill this year. So we will begin with that premise, and the governor's bill will be introduced, and we will have a hearing on the governor's bill in this committee. And then we will move on from there, again, exploring the various options as to the size and scope of the bill that we finally do, I hope. Any questions on that? All right. Then let's go around the table and do some introductions. I think I will start with the vice chair, Representative Uglum, and just your name, who you are, you know, what district you represent, maybe a brief highlight of your district, and we'll take it from there. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Uglum. I represent District 36A, which is Champlin and Coon Rapids. It's a wonderful district, Dean. And, no, actually, very fortunate to do that and represent them now for the last three terms. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Uglum. I think we'll go to Representative Hausman next.
And I'm Alice Hausman. I represent a couple of neighborhoods in St. Paul, St. Anthony Park and Como Park, and the cities of Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, and most of Roseville. If you have been to the State Fair or the St. Paul campus or Rosedale Mall, you've been in my district.
Okay, thank you. And now I think we will go to Representative Pearson, and then down and around we'll do members and then staff afterward.
Hi, Nels Pearson. I'm representative in District 26B, which covers 14 of the 18 townships in Olmsted County. And then I get about 50% of the population in my district lives within the city limits of Rochester. The other half live outside in the townships and rural areas. So first time on capital investment, honored and grateful to be here.
Yeah. State Representative Bob Detmer, I represent 39A, which includes Schaefer, Franconia, Forest Lake, Scandia, Marine, St. Croix, May Township, Stillwater Township, and parts of Stillwater. So I also chair the Veterans Committee, and I've been on this committee before. And I want to make a suggestion that when we do tour these projects, that we bring the Senate along with us and get one big bus. I know we have a new caucus now. It's called Back of the Bus Caucus. And it was a great time when we went around, and both Republicans and Democrats, we were sat in the back of the bus, and we made a lot of good decisions back there. So it was a lot of fun.
Senators in the back of the bus? I can't see it.
I sat in the back of the bus, and we had a great time.
And they wore suits. On bonding trips, they wear suits. Are you sure about this?
They would have to change. They would have to change to meet our standards. So,
yeah, you may be asking too much. Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keith Frankie, District 54A, parts of South St. Paul, Cottage Grove, and the entire cities of St. Paul Park, Newport, and Township of Gray Cloud. I'm just honored to be here, and my district is full of very smart people. And they elected me.
And my brother lives in his district.
Yeah. So thank you. I'm honored.
Representative Lilly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Leon Lilly. I represent three East Metro communities, North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale. And I don't really know how to describe my district. Kind of a bedroom community. We have the world's largest snowman, though, and I think the snowman likes to play with the ball of twine. And I'm the one member that was smart. Like, not only did I read my stuff already, Representative Carlson, I've read four of the chair's books. So you're going to have to up your game there, I think, Representative Carlson.
Make sure I get a list of your projects.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly is a member of the Back of the Bus Caucus. So
that's it.
Pictures to verify that.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jean Poppy. I represent District 27B, which is in southern Minnesota along the Iowa border, and the biggest city is Austin. It's most of Mauer County, except for one township in Dodge County, and one township in Fleabourn County. We kind of don't overlap, but we're very contiguous, Representative Bennett and I, so we share the Senate district. Austin has been a recipient of bonding dollars in the past. I have Riverline Community College, which has a campus in Austin. We have the Hormel Institute, which is a world-renowned cancer research institute, part of the University of Minnesota, and did receive significant bonding dollars, which I invite you all to come back to the Hormel Institute now to actually see what it looks like. It's a phenomenal facility, and they do remarkable work there. So I appreciate if you'd ever want to make that trip. Like to see you there. And we also have received bonding dollars for flood mitigation. So I appreciate the support that we've gotten over the years and look forward to serving on this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gunther.
I'm Bob Gunther. I come from District 23A. I have half of Jackson County, Watonwan County, all of Martin County, and 80% of Faribault County. I went up to Representative Bennett's district. And my county is the county that makes sure Austin and Hormel continue to operate. We are the third largest pork-producing county in the nation. So we keep them busy, and spam is a word.
Spam is a word, huh? Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm Representative Matt Crossell up for District 2A. And that covers Lake of the Woods County, Beltrami County, Clearwater County, and part of Hubbard County. excuse me. Give you an idea of the area. It goes from the northwest angle over to Black Duck, down to Akeley, and then over to Clearbrook. And one of the highlights, the highlight of that area is that I live there, and most of you come there to vacation or get away.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Rick Hansen, I represent the awesome part of South St. Paul, not the part that Representative Frankie has, but I also represent West St. Paul, Lilydale, which, Mr. Chair, you know, Lilydale had a bonding project, I think, in the bill last year. It was really an important one. It's, if you're going to Moose Country, I could show you a tour of that. Mendota and Mendota Heights. And so Northern Dakota County, and I'd encourage all the folks who are here that are spending time at the Capitol, come to Dakota County. We've got great restaurants. I know the chair likes to see some.
And Wednesday nights we do frequent Moose Country. Maybe we'll leave early sometime and visit your projects.
They're close.
Good afternoon. My name is Linda Runbeck. I represent District 38A, and the largest city in that district is Llano Lakes. We're nestled between 35E and 35W, bordered by that. And I believe I'm accurate to say that we have never received $1 of capital investment money. So maybe we can break that record this time around. We don't have any good restaurants, though. I mean, I don't think so. Nothing special.
Is this on camera?
We're open. We're open. We're open for development for great restaurants. And I'm serving in my sixth term in the legislature, in the House, I should say. The first two terms were back in 89 and 91.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. And you know, one of the finest things that a legislator can do is to support a bonding bill when they don't have a project in it.
Why is he looking at me?
Had an omen.
Oh, good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tim Miller. I represent District 17A. I don't know if this is even picking me up, which is the counties of Swift, Chippewa, all but two townships in Candiwa County, and then I have four townships in Candiwa High County. And now you got me all thinking about restaurants and stuff like that. We have the Lunchbox Cafe in Prinsburg. But I will tell you that I have seen the Ball of Twine, and I have been to the Spam Museum, Representative Poppy, and I would say that that's a little bit more of a destination. But I love the Ball of Twine. So I do have to make one comment, Mr. Chair, on the Ball of Twine, which I really like. Everyone knows that it's like in an environmentally controlled gazebo, right? So, but next to it is a mailbox, and it's just a steel mailbox. And you open it up, and unless it isn't there anymore,
it's there.
Every year they put in a I think it's every year they put in a spiral-bound notebook in there, and when you go visit the ball of twine, you write some notes into that spiral book, and then you put it back into the mailbox. And so I would encourage everyone to go see the ball of twine and make note of the ball of twine. Then you can prove to them that you were there to see it as well.
That's a good idea.
Yep. Well, part of our tour, right?
Yes. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Raymond Dean, I represent District 59B. I'm in my third term. Represent a good portion of downtown Minneapolis and the southern part of North Minneapolis, which is nine neighborhoods. I'm not going to name them all because chances are I'll forget one, and I don't know how all of you that remember the many, many counties that you represent never miss one, but maybe you do. You've been in my district if you've been to a Vikings game, a Twins game, or a Timberwolves game, so happy to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jack Considine, I represent 19B. That's about 90% of Mankato and the town of Eagle Lake, and I have one township, Mankato Township. That makes it easier to remember. Really looking forward to being on this committee and hopefully getting MSU, their clinical science building, finished.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Poston. I represent District 9A, which is southern Cass County, most of Todd County, and part of Wadena County. My district is about 20% cabin country and about 80% agriculture. I'm excited to be on your committee. Looking forward to the back of the bus.
You've got to earn it. Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tony Jurgens, and I represent the portion of Cottage Grove that Representative Frankie does not represent, plus Hastings, Afton, Ninninger Township, and Denmark Township. And one of the things that is a little bit different about our district is, for one thing, there's a lot of variety. Cottage Grove is more of a suburb. You've got a small river town in Afton. You have farmland in the two townships, and Hastings, being just a little bit further out, is more like a small town of its own. So I'm happy to be here and happy to support other people's projects if you are willing to support mine. Thank you.
Oh, you're learning.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm Dwayne Selk. I represent 25B, which is basically the northern half-ish of Rochester. Probably the most notable building in the place is the one of the world's largest manufacturing sites. It's the IBM building that you, if you've driven by, you've driven by the building. And what you see from the city or from the street is just a small piece of that building. It is a phenomenal building back there. So that we are still in the health business and core technologies business.
I'm Lyndon Carlson, District 45A, which is the cities of New Hope, Plymouth, and Crystal. I was trying to think of something that I was rather unique about the district, and it's a very nice suburban area, those three communities. But if you're a hockey buff, we have a hockey rink in New Hope, and that's where the Mighty Ducks film was filmed. Mm-hmm. And people still locally talk about that. I've been on this committee many years, although I was not on the committee last biennium, so I'm glad to be back. And when you talk about the senators wearing suits, I made the mistake of wearing a suit one time because I was going to be involved with another meeting during the day when we were touring some technical colleges. Brand new suit, first time I wore it. We're in one of the wood shops touring the technical college, and I get my leg caught on the a piece of wood sticking out, and found a good weaver, but I always knew that was
that
was
there. Running,
so I would recommend no suits on the tours. And if it helps, I did purchase one of your books. I didn't purchase all four, but the one on Lincoln. But maybe I'll remind you of that. I always tried to get him to get a discount. He wouldn't give a discount, so I finally gave up and bought one time.
Well, it might help.
If I buy one more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Rob Eklund. I represent 3A, and I envy you folks that can name off all your townships and towns and all that stuff, because when I printed out the precinct caucus voting list after the election, there was townships that I'd never heard of that were in my district. So, I won't try to name them all. I'm from International Falls, the largest town in my district, and I represent Coochsing County, all of Cook County, part of Northern St. Louis County, and most of Lake County. And the most unique thing my district I'm proud of, I'm proud to be home of both Voyageurs National Park and the Boundary Waters Canoe Area.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peggy Bennett. I represent 27A, starting my second term. And I'm southern Minnesota, sandwiched between Representative Poppy and Representative Gunther. Couldn't ask for better legislative neighbors. Albert Lee's our biggest area. And we have a lot of good restaurants in our area, actually. So one of my favorites, Plaza Morena, if we're ever down there, we should all stop by there. It's a good restaurant.
All right. Thank you. And I think all members have spoken, right? So we'll go to staff. We'll start right here.
My name is Jeremiah Wingstead, and I'm the CLA for this committee.
Brian Rosenblatt, GOP Research.
Gavin Hansen, Committee Administrator.
Would our page like to introduce herself?
Emma, I'm the committee page.
Emma the page? Okay. Thank you. Who's that? Devin and
Andy.
I knew that. I mean, I know what's next. I'm on introductions here. All right. So I haven't introduced myself yet. Okay. I am Representative Dean Erdahl. I represent Meeker County, one township in Wright County, and three townships in McLeod County, including half of the city of Hutchinson. Unique. I could go on and on about the unique things in my district, but I'll just mention two highlights. Of course, we do have the biggest wall of twine made by one man in Darwin. But I, Representative Lilly, I'm not contemplating a Twine Ball State Park.
Oh, really?
I'm not going to do that. And then, of course, we have in Litchfield First District, which takes in from 47 counties, 7 million pounds of milk every day, turns it into cheese, and if you've ever had like a Tostito, it's coated with cheese from Litchfield. Every Tostito in the world is coated with cheese from Litchfield. So, with that, who am I supposed to call on next?
Devin Andy.
Oh, Devin Andy. Okay, so, we will not, what we're doing here today, members is, and particularly for the veteran members, understand that we do have a lot of new members here, of freshmen. And so we're going to do a bit of a primer on bonding, the basics of bonding, and so that we can develop a little refresher course for those who are veterans, but, you know, some valuable new knowledge for those who are not. And so with that, we have Deborah Dyson and Andy Lee. And I've been on capital investment, I think, for 10 years and have come to value the assistance and the opinions of these two very much. And so, Deb and Andy, would you begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Deb Dyson. I'm from the House Research Department. And I'm going to start off the presentation that we have today. We were asked to do a quick overview of state capital investment and bonding, and so one of the things I did was just look up the definition of bonds, and they're, whether they're state or local government, they are municipal securities, and they're issued to finance any number of things, capital projects like buildings and roads and sewers, for not the state, but in other circumstances it might be for funding day-to-day operations. This is a in the general sense. And then what the issuer, the municipality or the state, is agreeing to repay the bondholders the principal with interest in a specified time. Bonds are described any number of ways, and so I just put together a slide that indicates that they might be described based on who's issuing the bonds, whether it's the state, a municipality, a special district, the purpose of the bonds, transportation bonds, building bonds, sewer bonds, the source of the payment, general obligations, revenues, the maturity structure, serial versus term, the price, the tax status of the bonds, whether it's a taxable bond or a tax-exempt bond, the rate for the bonds, variable versus fixed rate, and the term short and long-term bonds. The authority for bonds in that with what you will be dealing with in this committee has three main sources. There's the state constitution, first and foremost, and that is in Article 11, Sections 4 and 5 for general obligation bonds. There's nothing in the constitution that speaks to revenue bonds, and but the general obligation bonds are limited by the state constitution. Next, you have the Minnesota statutes, and most of the statutes dealing with state bonding are in Chapter 16A of the statutes. And then there's also federal law that governs the primarily it's dealing with the tax status of the bonds that are issued. Looking at the constitutional limitations on state general obligation bonds, the Constitution requires all public spending to be for a public purpose, and that includes state bonds. In order for the state to issue general obligation bonds, the purpose has to be one that's authorized in the state constitution. The Constitution requires that the purpose be specified in the law authorizing the issuance of the bonds and that the bonds mature in no more than 20 years. There is also one of the things I forgot to mention is there should be a handout in your packets of it's an information brief that was last revised in January of 2015, but it is called Capital Investment in State Bonding, and the origination in the House that is essentially, we don't have any case law specifically on that in Minnesota, but because there is a, in the Constitution, a unlimited statewide property tax that could be levied to pay off the bonds if there is not a general fund appropriation to pay for the bond repayment, bond counsel has advised that it's possible that a court could deem that a bonding bill is a revenue-raising bill, and therefore it has to originate in the House. And so bonding bills, like tax bills in Minnesota, originate in the House. The primary purposes that will show up in the bonding bill that you all will be dealing with are bonds to acquire and better public land and buildings. And this is actually a specific paragraph within Article 11, Section 5 of the State Constitution. They are for capital projects, and for what is a capital project, we have bond counsel advice that a capital project is a fixed asset. It has to have a useful life of at least 10 years. It's not the accounting definition of a capital project. It has to be publicly owned. The Constitution refers to public improvements, and so the advice that we work from is that they are publicly owned, which means it's owned by the state or a political subdivision of the state. And then finally, the Constitution requires that a bill authorizing the issuance of state general obligation bonds be passed by a three-fifths majority of both bodies. The Constitution has other authorized uses of state general obligation bonds. I put in, it's in the handout and in the PowerPoint, but this is the list taken from the Constitution, and it includes the repelling invasion and suppressing insurrection that goes back to just before statehood. The date in the parentheses is when the provision was added to the Constitution. You have in there temporary borrowing for certificates of indebtedness and refunding bonds, the highway bonds, and that's also in conjunction with, I think it's Article 14 of the Constitution that deals with trunk highway bonding. You can see the list there. What is notable about all of these is that not all of these other paragraphs of the Constitution are capital projects. For example, for the aviation, you also have the ability to issue bonds for operating airports. And not all of these require the three, and these are the paragraphs that are not subject to that three-fifths vote requirement. Other sources of capital funding, not everything has to be done with bonding, and in fact not everything can be done with bonding since the Constitution limits the purposes for which bonds can be used. So there's the general fund that can be used for capital projects and has been, and there's revenue bonding. One of the limitations on revenue bonding is that the project has to have revenue in order to pay back the bonds. Appropriation bonds are a relatively new use in Minnesota, going back only to 2006 with the Gopher Stadium as a essentially an agency bond where the University of Minnesota issued the debt and the legislature put into statute the appropriation to pay back, I'm not sure if it's all of the debt or a portion of it. Then 2008, we had the appropriation bonds, or essentially a standing appropriation of a general fund money to pay the debt service on bonds issued by the Housing Finance Agency for nonprofit housing and the housing infrastructure bonds. In 2011, there were the appropriation bonds issued that helped balance the state budget at that time. There's also lease purchase financing for equipment and for real estate, and then there are the credit enhancement programs where the and that is administered by the Public Facilities Authority, and that's for local governments, cities, counties, and school districts, where they can get an enhancement to their credit rating because the bonds that they are issuing are backed by the state, but the local governments, if they ever tap into that, would have to pay back the state. Included in what this committee will be looking at are capital appropriation cancellations. In Minnesota Statute 16A.642, there's a provision that provides that January 1st of each odd-numbered year, so this year, Minnesota Management and Budget reports on cancellation of projects that are more than 4 years old that have not been moving forward and have unobligated, unencumbered, or unspent project balances. If a project is moving forward, this should not affect that, but when something is done or is not going to be proceeding, this statute would provide for the projects to be in that report, and effectively those projects are then canceled and those amounts are done. The legislation says that they're canceled effective July 1st, the beginning of the next fiscal year, unless the legislature reauthorizes them. Other topics that I wanted to touch very briefly on, and I'm hoping that that there'll be a little more discussion of these, but one topic is the no reimbursement. This relates to federal tax law, and I just wanted to mention that one. When projects come in, it's for projects that are at the beginning that or a phase of a project where the project has not been, the work hasn't been done, but more significantly, I think, for federal tax purposes, is that they, that the money has not been spent on the project. So we're not reimbursing local government. This primarily relates to local governments, but the state is not reimbursing for money that's already been spent. The role of bond counsel is very important in what happens with the bonding bill, because in order for bonds to be sold, there has to be an opinion by a bond attorney stating that both explaining what the tax status of the bonds is, but also making an assertion that the bonds are legally authorized. And so much of our guidance on how what is bondable and how to describe it comes from bond counsel. The Attorney General's office acts as bond counsel and also retains outside counsel, which I believe is still Kutak Rock. At this time, and just wanted to mention that bond counsel plays a very important role in the development of the bill. Use of state bond finance property, this again relates primarily to local units of government, and how they use the property and whether or not they're entering into lease management agreements with nonprofits for administration of the public program. There are restrictions on this. With bond projects, because of the public ownership requirement, the public entity that owns it also has to have authority to operate the program that's going into that facility and is responsible for making sure that the program is administered the way it was intended and what the agreements are. It's not a fiscal agent kind of relationship that you'll hear in other committees with regard to appropriations. And there is a commissioner's order that explains how this works and when it applies. Non-state match requirements. There are a lot of different ways that ends up getting described in the bonding bill. Sometimes it's must have a match of equal amount. Sometimes it says no match is required. The staff between the Senate, the MMB and the House have been talking about how to be more consistent in how we describe that, but I think the most important provision that you need to understand is that there is a statute, and it was put in place to make it clear what bond counsel has always said, which is bond funds are not there to build part of a building. You have to be able to complete the project as described in the rider and have funds committed, resources committed to it before the bond funds are released. The statute that I'm talking about is 16A.502, and it basically says that until there are enough resources to complete the project as described, no money is released. So even if you say 50-50, if the appropriation is not enough and the 50% match is there, they might still not get the money released to them until it's clear that the project can be completed as described. So the one takeaway I want you to understand from that is you have to be able to complete it as described. So the descriptions in the riders, the spreadsheets are very important for understanding how the budget is working, but the rider language in the bill is what governs what the project is and whether or not it's there. And the rider language is important for understanding what can be done with the money and how that works. So I just wanted to highlight that. I think this might be my last slide. I've got one more after this. But the last thing I wanted to mention on other topics, and each of these are described a little bit more in the information brief that was handed out, but I put in a comparison of state and local bonding, sort of four big differences, because many people have experience with local bonding, and there are differences. Local governments have the powers that the legislature has given them. The state is limited. The state's bonding authority is limited by the Constitution. So in some respects, local governments can have greater scope for their bonding projects than the state can. One is a referendum requirement. Local governments, unless some exception applies, they have to hold a referendum on issuing debt. And the legislature is making that decision on issuing debt. Limits on debt. The state has guidelines, which will be talked about later, but local governments, there are limits in the statutes unless the legislature exempts them from the limits. Public ownership. Local governments are not necessarily limited to bonding for publicly owned projects. It still has to have a public purpose. As I said, all public spending must be for a public purpose. And then purposes for which bonds can be issued by local governments can be broader than for what the state has, again, because the Constitution limits what the state can do. I just wanted to include a list of state bond issuers. Obviously, the Department of Management and Budget is issuing the bulk of the bonds that are issued by the state, but there are agencies that have bonding authority as well. The Housing Finance Agency has revenue bonding authority, the mortgage revenue bonds. University of Minnesota issues its own debt. The Public Facilities Authority has its revenue bonding authority. Anyway, you can see the list. It's just to point out that there are a number of agencies with this authority. And I think at this point, Mr. Chair, I conclude my presentation, and Mr. Lee was going to pick up from here.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff. I'll be starting briefly touching on the capital investment guidelines. This is not a law. This is a policy adopted and maintained by the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget. And there will be a presentation after mine that will go into a little bit more depth in these guidelines. But just very briefly, there's three guidelines, one that limits the total principal outstanding on all debt, so that's the debt that the state is currently paying on, to be no more than 3.25% of state personal income. And that's a macroeconomic number that's estimated by MMB. The second guideline is that the principal for the issued debts of the amount that we're paying on and the amount that's in guideline one, plus the authorized but unissued debt, so that's debt that the legislature has okayed but the bonds haven't been sold yet because the project isn't ready, and a few other more miscellaneous types of debt, cannot exceed 6% of state personal income. That's the second guideline. And the third guideline has to do with the rate at which the general obligation bonds are paid off. 40% must be paid off within 5 years, 70% within 10 years, and the bonds cannot last longer than 20 years. Moving on then to committee accounts, these are the budget spending items for the Capital Investment Committee, and I have two handouts in your packet. The first one that I'll be going over is the general fund debt service from the November 2016 forecast. It looks like this. It's just a one-page sheet. So this table is a summary of the various debt obligate or the debt service that the state is paying on various tax-supported debt. The first few lines, lines 3 through 9, are all of the appropriation bonds that Ms. Dyson mentioned earlier. You can see the Housing Finance Agency, and that's a number of different issues over many years. The U of M projects, the TCF Bank Stadium, and the biomedical facilities. And then on line 6, you see the state appropriation refunding bonds, which is about $57 million a year. That is the payment for a short-term loan that the state took out in 2011 to address a general fund budget gap of about $650 million. So we securitized in a stream from the tobacco bonds as a part of a revenue bond, but then later refinanced that as appropriation bonds. So this is essentially the general fund paying back for a loan for that one-time budget gap in 2011. Then on line 7, you see the Vikings Stadium. This also includes transfers to Minneapolis and St. Paul. So that's sort of not just the debt service, but all of the components of that legislation. The Lewis and Clark Water Project. And on line 9, you see $13.6 million. This is, as Ms. Dyson mentioned earlier, some of the cash spending, the general fund spending that happened in with the bonding bill in the 2015 special session. And then on line 13, approximately $609 million in fiscal 2016 spending is the debt service on all of the general obligation bonds. Just very briefly touching on kind of what the scope of all the outstanding debt is, there's another one-page sheet that looks like this on one side and also has some pie charts on the other. This is just the total principal outstanding, and I just have a table for the that relates to guideline one. So this is the amount of principal that the state is currently paying debt on, and so you can see the various bonds. Also, just a note on line 13, you see some real estate and other debts that relates to other tax-supported debt that's being paid in other areas that aren't part of the Capital Investment Committee accounts. So that's the lease purchase agreements that are paid to the St. Paul Port Authority and for the new legislative office building. That's essentially baked into other committee budgets that are paying back the debt for those. And then just on the other side, I have some pie charts of sort of the relative proportion of the debt, and you can see the largest piece being a little over half the total state debt, tax-supported debt, is geo-various purpose debt, and about a quarter is trunk highway debt, and then the more miscellaneous appropriation bonds. And that is all for me. So if there's any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lee and Ms. Dyson, who, again, do a fine job, and they generally travel on our trip as well. Now, questions, members? Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is for Mr. Lee. The state appropriation refunding bonds, I see we're paying at least through 2021. When are those bonds totally retired then?
You know? Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I'll have to get back to you on that, or actually people at M&B would probably have that answer. I believe those were 25-year bonds, and so they were refinanced in 2012. But let me double-check. They could be okay. 25.
Yeah, that'll be fine. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Dyson or Mr. Lee on the bonding ability after a project is started. I want to go to a project in my district. So with Robert Street, once that construction started, that makes it ineligible for general obligation bonds. Is that correct?
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, my understanding from recent discussions, it gets into the federal tax law issues, and that's where I am not very well versed at all. It's a payment for the projects, and so the shorthand has always been no reimbursement once the project started, because typically projects are being paid for once they're under construction. If for some reason some contractor is building everything and then is just going to wait and see if the state will pay for it, there may be some avenue there. But a second reason why it has always been no reimbursement is that the state has an interest in having a project, in having the description of the project and then what's actually done match, and sort of this is what the state wants to have done, and then the project goes that route so that the grant agreement works. But I would defer to the MMB staff to talk about this issue of reimbursement.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a better way to ask the question is maybe a more appropriate funding mechanism would be a trunk highway bond versus a general obligation bond. If you have the reimbursement question.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I'm not sure it makes a difference that it's a trunk highway bond. It's still a federal tax law issue related to bonding. I think you're talking about trunk highway fund, perhaps, if it's eligible under trunk highway funding. There are other restrictions that apply to from the Constitution about what's eligible under the trunk highway fund for being paid for. But when you're talking about bonds, it's that federal tax law issue.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, Mr. Lee, on the last sheet you passed out on line 16, the Ag Health buildings on the principal debt. So if those costs are absorbed in an agency budget, are those agency budgets, I'm trying to think of the line items. I don't remember if I see the line items. So is it something where a percentage comes off from both general fund and dedicated funds to pay for that? Or is it an open appropriation that was established when that building was built?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I will have to double-check on those specific items. I think I would believe that they're part of the direct appropriations to the agencies. I don't think that there's a open statutory appropriation for rent, but I will double-check and get back to the committee on those. And Mr. Chair, really briefly, looked into Representative Carlson's question. The state general fund appropriation refunding bonds, the final maturity is 2030.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. Dyson. Good afternoon. Getting back to what Representative Hansen was talking about, a little bit about starting projects and things like that, how is the definition of starting a project? If you're doing some pre-engineering, some feasibility studies, environmental studies and things like that, before you turn a shovel, before you go out for bid, and things like that, those studies and background that you have to do before you start a project, we're not defining that as starting a project, are we?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Uglum, you are if you are going to try and pay for it with geo bonds. I go back to the description of what are you getting an appropriation for. There are projects where some of the work, the pre-design or some design work has been done by the local government and they are coming in asking for construction money. The beginning of the project is the construction, but it's going to be fact project specific. Okay. And again, because a lot of this has to do with how this plays out under the tax laws, I would defer to the experts on that.
Representative, just to follow up, Ms. Dyson, I think with every project, and it doesn't matter what it is, it's important to understand when we're doing the ask for the amount of the project. Without doing some background study and engineering, sometimes you don't know how much to ask for. So that line is a little blurred, I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Uglum, you make a good point. I think in the past, especially for state projects, that's one of the reasons why the legislature has sort of mapped things out with doing pre-design in one biennium that gives you a scope of a project. Design gives you the details and what the actual cost would be, and then construction is something else. There's been sometimes it all gets compressed into one appropriation and the cost may not be clear. But when you talk about planning or studies, that's one of those sets of magic words that make people go, what do you really mean? Because there is the decision to start a project, and you know what you're going to do, and that's a capital improvement according to bond council. That's you started that project when you're doing a study and asking, should we do a project? That's not bondable. So, again, it gets into, you know, what is the actual project description? What are you doing? But, I mean, you're right that if you're trying to do pre-design, design, construct, furnish, and equip all at once, you may not know exactly how much this is going to end up costing.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to provide a different perspective on both of those questions, the Robert Street and the one you – I mean, to his question, though, it has to do with what you contracted for. For example, if in one bill we say pre-design and design, and that is what we contract for, that you can do. And then the next time you come, and now we're going to construct – I mean, so you can, that's not considered starting the project for the pre-design and design because you haven't started construction. So those are possible. And to the Robert Street, so just to clarify that word, no reimbursement. So if Robert Street has started, no reimbursement means not with geo bonding, but you could reimburse with cash.
Yes.
So, I mean, I was thinking we had just slightly different perspectives on both of those.
Hey, thank you. Do you have anything to add to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, correct. I mean, that's been one of the recommendations for that project is to look at cash because of that, the concerns with what's done, what isn't done, how it mixes together. In that particular project, there has been an issue. Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Lee and Ms. Dyson, and we'll be working with you for the next couple of years. Thank you. At this time, we will have Jennifer Hosmer present on behalf of MMB. And while we are awaiting her arrival at the table, I believe another member has shown up of this committee. Would he care to introduce himself and the district he's from and anything in particular of interest in his district?
Representative Dale Lewick, District 10B, Aiken and rural Crow Wing County, and a number of interests, particularly Cuyuna Lakes State Recreational Area. We're working on some stuff there to improve, as my friend Representative Lewick is well aware of, and we visited that last year.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. And now, Ms. Hosmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jennifer Hosmer. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management at Minnesota Management and Budget. You already heard from Deb Dyson that MMB is charged with selling the bonds that are issued in the bonding bill every year, and we also work with state agencies and local units of government to implement the capital budgets that are funded. I have two goals today while I'm here before you. One is to give a little bit more detail on the state's capital investment guidelines, and then the second is to flesh out some more of the what the process is once a project receives funding from the legislature, so that there's some sort of baseline expectations about the projects that do get funded. Hopefully I've tried to not overlap with Ms. Dyson and Mr. Lee's presentations too much, so I will tailor remarks appropriately here. So first, in regards to the state's capital investment guidelines, the state has had guidelines in place since 1979. Our current version has been in place since 2009. And what the guidelines do is really help guide decision-making and communicate policy goals as discussions about a capital budget are underway. They also demonstrate a commitment to long-term funding for capital projects. The guidelines that we have in place since 2009 were designed to be more consistent with what the rating agencies were looking at in terms of our debt portfolio, and were brought more in line, made more consistent with what other states were using as well. From this perspective, they are now inclusive of all of the debt obligations of the state. We refer to them as net tax-supported debt that could potentially be paid for out of the state general fund. And then the guidelines also are designed to communicate what the state's strong financial management are. We have ratings from three rating agencies, and just last year, last August, one of the rating agencies, Fitch, upgraded us to a AAA rating.
And the other two are?
The other two, Moody's has us at AA1 with a stable outlook, and S&P has us rated at AA positive with a positive outlook.
Thank you.
So Mr. Lee had recited what the three capital investment guidelines are, and here I just show where we are currently measuring as a state in regards to our management to those guidelines. MMB does produce a debt capacity forecast that gets released with the budget and economic forecast every November and February, and we update these numbers at those points in time. So the numbers on the slide here represent what we reported in the November 2016 debt capacity forecast. In regards to the total amount of debt that we have sold, supported by the state general fund, you can see that that measure is currently 2.76 of state personal income, which is below the threshold. And in regards to the total authorized debt, both what we have sold and what is authorized but unissued, the percentage to personal income is currently 3.55. In regards to how quickly we are repaying our debt, 40.3% scheduled to mature within 5 years, and 71.2% is scheduled to mature within 10 years. And one of the rationales of this guideline is that the state pays down its debt obligations quickly, and that helps realize the cost of a bonding bill and make room for additional future bonding authorizations more quickly in the future. The next slide that I have here is just a table that we include with our debt capacity forecast and just wanted to orient you to it very briefly. This lists the general categories of all the debt that we have outstanding. The first column represents the principal that is outstanding, so the bonds that we have sold, and that is the figure that is used to calculate guideline number one metrics. And then we report what remaining authorization is based on past legislative authorizations, and we currently have about $663 million in remaining authorization that we could sell bonds for. And then the third and final column, if you add that all the way up to the bottom, that adds in what we have sold, what is authorized but unissued, and then certain other moral obligations and equipment capital leases to get to the second, the guideline number two. So unless there are any questions on our capital investment guidelines, I'll move right into sort of the expectations of what grantees and recipients of bond appropriations will need to be mindful of in terms of the process for receiving their funding. State funds are technically available for capital projects the day following enactment of a bonding bill. But as some of the, as Ms. Dyson has communicated, some of the restrictions that do apply to bonding appropriations, those funds cannot be disbursed until all of the requirements have been met for that project. If a project is ready to go before the state has sold bonds, and there I think I'll take just a moment and say that it is not a requirement that the state sell bonds for a project in a newly authorized bonding bill. We do have authority, statutory authority, to borrow against the general fund to make money available for projects that might come be ready before the state sells bonds for that project. We would only borrow against the general fund the amount that would be needed for that project, and as soon as we sell the bonds, we immediately repay the general fund. So that's just to communicate that projects can get underway as soon as a bonding bill has been enacted. For Trunk Highway Fund projects, we do have authority then to also borrow from the Trunk Highway Fund under similar situations.
Representative Jergens, do you have a question on this section?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I'm reading a little slow, so you've already moved down, but I do have a question back on the guidelines. On screen number four, as you can see, we're real close to the thresholds, especially guideline number three, looking at the 40% threshold and the actual 40.3. How do we know how these numbers might have been impacted by not having a bonding bill last year?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm trying to think how we would, those numbers represent the bonds that we've actually sold, and when we sell the bonds, we work to structure them to meet guideline number three so that we have some options when we sell them to make sure that bonds are maturing within that 40% are maturing within the 5 years and 70% within the 10 years. So that is independent of the authorizations that exist.
Thank you. Continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So some of the other, so this is slide eight now, some of the other general requirements to be mindful of is that when bonding appropriations are appropriated for local unit of government projects, those local units of government will need to enter into a grant agreement with the state. And they work with the state agency that actually receives the appropriation within the bonding bill. As Ms. Dyson had mentioned, the recipients have approximately 4 years to get their project underway. Otherwise, unspent, unobligated, unencumbered funds will cancel in the cancellation report. And MMB did just release a cancellation report earlier this month, which showed amounts from the 2012 bonding bill and earlier. And that report showed a total of roughly $17.5 million in projects where those funds will cancel on July 1st of this year unless the legislature takes action to extend any of those appropriations. Grantees must have independent statutory authority to operate a project, and they must demonstrate to the granting agency that they have a plan and an ability to fund the program that will be intended for the facility. At the time of receiving an appropriation, This ties to federal tax law in some regard, that there cannot be an expectation that the public entity will sell the project. If circumstances change in the future and a public entity does desire to sell a project financed with state bonds, they would need to comply with state law provisions and the process laid out therein, including determining by official action that the project is no longer needed and usable. And then any sale would have to be for fair market value, and the state would get the first dollar to get the bonding grant repaid. Ms. Dyson already spoke about the full funding requirement, but it is important enough that it's probably worth spending just a couple more seconds on. 16A502, as she mentioned, is the statute that prevents the disbursement of any state funds until all funding is in place to complete the project. MMB does have a capital grants manual that we make available to all recipients of bonding appropriations that hopefully does a good job of laying out a lot of this process for the recipients so they can understand the process. And that the capital grants manual does go into some detail in terms of what documentation would be acceptable to the state in regards to the various funding sources that they might be bringing to the table. So it would be different, for example, based on whether it's federal funds, local city or county or local funds. If there's a capital campaign and pledges being raised, there's information there about what documentation would be required. And as we look at to comply with that statute from MMB's perspective, we do look carefully at how the project has been described in the bonding bill to determine what is the total budget that we should be looking at to determine how much in non-state funds we need to be verifying. So MMB, the vast majority of the projects that get funded in a bonding bill do get their authority from the constitutional provision in Article 11, Section 5, Subdivision A, which is the capital projects authorization and requires the three-fifths vote. Just to summarize briefly before going into some more detail, these projects must be for a public purpose. Private benefit cannot be dominant in regards to the project, and the public entity is responsible for implementing the public purpose. The projects must be publicly owned. That could be fee ownership, outright ownership, or there are procedures in place where qualifying long-term ground leases or easements could also be deemed the equivalent of fee ownership. And MMB does have to approve those long-term real estate interests, and we work with the grantees on that as appropriate. The purpose of the bonds must be clearly set forth in the law, and this becomes important if the rider does not mention some element to be funded, for example, acquisition, but then it comes to light later that the project does really require funding for acquisition. If the rider in the bonding bill does not mention an element of the project, then the bond funds cannot be used to finance that element of the project. And that would be true even if those elements are eligible capital expenditures otherwise. In addition to the Constitution, the process is set forth in state statute in 16A695 and a commissioner's order that MMB has had in place for many years. The latest iteration is the fourth order put in place in July of 2012. The Internal Revenue Code sets forth additional restrictions that MMB is responsible for making sure are complied with. In addition to the reimbursement issue that's been talked about today already, there are various restrictions on the use of the property that get financed with tax-exempt bonds. And I'll get into some of those use restrictions in a couple slides just to give a high-level overview. We do not do a sufficient job of complying with the Internal Revenue Code provisions, there is a chance that the state's bonds could lose their tax-exempt status. And that is a tax-preferred status that leads to cheaper financing options for the state. Bond finance property is just a term of art I wanted to orient you to. It is set forth in the statutes governing the use of bond proceeds for projects. It's defined in 16A 695 as property acquired or bettered wholly or partly with geo bond proceeds. And it retains this characterization for a time period equal to 125% of the useful life of the finance project. The statute requires MMB approval of any use agreements, so for example, lease agreements, management contracts that will be in place at the property, and then sets forth the special rules that apply to the sales that I mentioned briefly before. The commissioner's order contains a further requirement that a declaration must be recorded in the land records of the various counties to evidence these restrictions on the use and sale of bond finance property. So a little information on use agreements, because these are agreements that we do regularly see in the projects that get funded in a bonding bill. 16A 695 defines a use agreement as a lease, management contract, or other contract between the public owner of the state bond finance property and another party operating or using it. It could be another public party. It could be a private party. The commissioner's order contains further rules, and to help the users of the bond proceeds work through what these rules are, MMB does employ the use of a use agreement checklist that helps them make sure that they have all of their provisions lined up appropriately. MMB, under the statute, MMB is required to approve use contracts at state bond finance property. Any use contract is required to be carrying out for the purpose of carrying out a governmental program. And the recipient, the public entity, is required to maintain adequate oversight of the program being operated in the facility. The term under state statute of any use contract must be substantially less than the useful life of the property's useful life. And in the commissioner's order, we further define that as meaning a good rule of thumb would be 50% or less of the useful life for the initial term. Renewals would be allowed. However, the renewals should be at the sole discretion of the public entity that is the deemed owner of the project. If there are any revenues being collected under a lease agreement, state statute also requires that a portion of any of those revenues be shared with the state and are repaid to MMB and go towards paying off the state's bonds. The IRS, again, in their rules in regards to tax-exempt bonding, is one of the driving factors in terms of some of these rules that are in place regarding use contracts at these facilities. They have this concept in the federal tax regulations of private use that you may hear about from time to time on projects. And they take a very broad look at what is private use. They do not want too much private use in play at projects financed with tax-exempt bonds because of the favorable tax treatment that those bonds receive. And their broad definition is really private use is any direct or indirect use by a non-governmental person. And that extends to the federal government, to nonprofits, to Native American tribes. And that use could be in many different forms, from ownership, leases or subleases, management contracts, energy output contracts, special legal entitlements, or special economic benefits. The federal tax law does limit how much private use can be attributed to any issue of bonds, and the state is limited to $15 million of private use for each of our bond issues. To put that in some perspective, just this last summer, we had a new issue of general obligation bonds in the realm of $300 million, and we would be capped at $15 million out of that issue that could be attributed to private use. It is something that MMB manages very carefully, because the consequence of violating that, if the IRS were to discover this on an audit or through some other, generally through an audit, they could deem the entire issue as taxable, and then the state would be liable for paying what the interest cost would have been if we had sold as taxable debt to begin with. There are many safe harbors that could apply, and we are routinely working with state agencies and local units of government to encourage them to work with bond counsel, with MMB, to help them structure these arrangements so that we can qualify for a safe harbor. If we do that, then that use would not count against the $15 million limitation. So we encourage entities to work with us at their earliest opportunity so we can help them structure their arrangements to take advantage of these safe harbors. The next slide, and I believe my last slide for you today, just has a list of what could feasibly be deemed private use under the federal tax regulations. Just to flag potential areas to look at a little bit further with you, concession agreements, vending agreements, car rental and special parking contracts, naming rights, broadcast rights, advertising rights do fall under the guise of private use, outright leases. For higher education facilities, sometimes research and collaboration agreements qualify as private use. And then cell phone towers, solar panels, electric charging stations can also fall within that category. The last piece of information I would leave you with today is our website, where we do have further explanation for a lot of the details that I've just very briefly summarized here today for you, a whole host of information from the Capital Grants Manual that, as you speak with your constituents during session, if you would encourage them to that resource, it is a valuable piece of information that helps set expectations in this regard. I'd be happy to answer any other questions, but that is my presentation for today.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hasmer. And I have one question that probably a lot of folks have. Under current statute, how much could be bonded now before we hit the threshold?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did not include that in the presentation today. However, in the November 2016 debt capacity forecast, we did update the table that I understand was used for discussion purposes in session last year. And I will appropriately situate this table as I give you the figure, as I flip to it here. In our debt capacity forecast, which you could find the full document on our website, and I'd be happy to send the link afterwards if you would like it, we have a section on page 6 called maximum debt capacity under the current guidelines. And on this chart, we show that in fiscal 17, the maximum new debt authorizations could be $3.45 billion. I will caveat that in regards to a couple of ways. That figure takes into account all tax-supported debt, so not just general obligation bonds, but also trunk highway bonds, state appropriation bonds, and those real estate capital leases that were discussed earlier. Another thing to keep in mind is that when there is a new bonding authorization, MMB does not sell all of that authorization at once. So even if there were that amount, which I should caveat further, is nowhere near a recommendation to the legislature as to what an appropriate level of debt would be. It is merely what is permitted under our guidelines at this time. We would not sell that full amount of debt this year. So because the full cost of a bonding bill is actually realized over 3 to 5 years, it takes some time for that amount to be realized in our capital investment guidelines. If you look at the table, it would take 2 years for that amount to max out under our guideline number one. And, of course, changes in personal income would also affect this calculation in future forecasts.
Oh, thank you. And I've been given some figures, just want to have you verify them, that regarding debt service over the biennium, it's about $1.2 billion.
Is that correct? Mr. Chair, it's about $1.2 billion.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just say a word about that because in our way back when we did in the 70s, we only measured general obligation bonds, but when Governor Pawlenty rewrote them in the year 2000 or whatever that was, when he said we want to measure all debt obligations, now it suddenly matters what the Transportation Committee does because, and I've just been hearing little rumors that maybe they'd want to get aggressive about trunk highway bonds. But now in these guidelines, inclusive of all debt guidelines, those would be part of the total. So what that committee does with trunk highway bonds potentially would affect what you might have the capacity to do. So I'm always kind of watching to see what's happening there. The one suggesting, Mr. Chair, that I would have, because she referenced the rating agency reports, I think it would be helpful for the committee to see the three agency reports because about the only time we talk about those, the rating that we get, is when we talk about the bonding bill. So I think everybody thinks it's linked to the bonding bill. And suddenly they think, well, if we have a big bonding bill, our rating will go down. But really, it's almost inconsequential. If you read those reports, the very first thing they always say about why we have a sound rating is we have a diverse economy. We're not dependent on one industry. And so that, as a result, they rate us very healthy. About all they ever say about debt is Minnesota has a reasonable debt level. We're about in the middle of the pack. That's about the only line they ever give about that. I wanted to say just a word about one thing where I think there's been a little confusion today, and it came from that discussion of what does it mean to have started a project and what does it mean all financing must be in place to complete a project. And maybe I'd use the Science Museum as the example. Last year, the Science Museum came to us with a project, and that's how we would have viewed it. And then we didn't pass a bill. They couldn't wait because they couldn't have any more damage to that building. And so very, very carefully, they've divided that project into phase one and phase two, described very carefully and contracted very carefully. And so I think that there was, and Representative Considine, I think that's probably relevant to what you did in terms of what you think of as a half-done project. It really is two projects. And so I think there was maybe a little confusion about that relative to a few things that are underway.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Carlson?
Representative Rita. Yeah, I've got a couple of questions, but one of them coincides with this project's must be complete. And maybe somebody can answer this. We've had in a capital area here a few years ago, we had a building that was not totally completed. There were like two floors that remained to be completed, and I guess they must have run out of money or had some overruns or something. But when you say it must be completed, that one was not completed. If you have a comment on that. Otherwise, I wanted to go back to the private use because both your testimony and earlier testimony referenced that. Mm-hmm. And I think it still exists, or at least we used to have a small agency of two or three employees, and it was an independent agency, or still is, that worked with capital investments for the private colleges. And I'm trying to remember if we actually issued the bonds and then they reimbursed the state of Minnesota. But that would be a private use. And does that still happen? Does that agency exist? By the way, they had a very good track record. They always paid the state off or paid them off. So there wasn't a problem that way. But I'm just thinking of the law and the references to private use because they are private colleges or universities.
Ms. Hosmer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. To your first point, I think the only comment I would have is that when we make the full funding determination, it is at the time that the entity is seeking to receive the state grant funds. So it's a point-in-time look at the beginning of a project. So if circumstances change, that could have resulted in the situation you were referring to. In regards to the second, I'm not familiar with that example, and it would probably come down to the facts of what that exact situation was, and I'd be happy to look into that further and get back to you if you'd like.
Mr. Chairman, you mean
thank
the private
you.
College
person?
Yeah. I don't even know if the, it, they used to appear a number of years ago before this committee, that small agency, and testify, and then we somehow would periodically, I think, raise the cap if one of the universities in that sector was going to have a major project. The reason I was asking that was you referenced a cap of, you gave an example and said, well, then the cap would be $15 million. And I was just wondering how all that would interplay if that is still happening. And the reason we did that for the private college is the argument was at the time that because the state could get lower interest rates and so on, that it was to the advantage, and they always emphasized very strongly that they had a good track record of paying off the debt. I'd appreciate some information on that, if the agency even exists now. But I would assume they did because they were engaged in long-term, or would, because they were engaged in long-term obligations. Another area when we talk about private use, I'm not totally sure where these leases come into play. I think we used general obligation bonds when we refinanced the Target Center or bought it. And part of the building was devoted to a fitness center and remained that way because it had been built originally by a couple of families that had as part of the Target Center a fitness center at the lower level. And then I'm aware of at least one hockey rink where there's a fitness center. It's owned by, and out my way, the city of Plymouth. And then part of that building is leased or something by a fitness center in a fairly significant amount of square footage. And the rest of it is two sheets of ice. So I'm just kind of interested in getting a little more detail on how that works. In fact, I may have a bill a little bit later on that particular hockey rink. So I want to know how that would interact as far as the private use part of it and the lease in management and how that all comes together. So thank you.
I take it there wasn't a question in there. So
that was the last part was a comment, Mr. Okay. Chairman, about just to soliciting more information about how that private use interacts with the state bonding authority when you have a significant, well, a total building in some instances, in the case of the private colleges, in other instances, a part of a building that, and then we do have some situations where you have public buildings that have a lot of vendors, food service buildings and so on. I'm not aware of any recently, but we did have the University of Minnesota Morris Student Union was built with general obligation bonds. This was a small university and didn't have the financial resources that some of the larger universities have to fund their student unions. And in those kinds of buildings, there's a lot of different vendors ranging from food service to bankers coming in and having a location in those buildings. So that was more a soliciting of information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. And unless you have answers you'd care to give him now, perhaps you could communicate with Representative Carlson and give him a more in-depth answer to those questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we would be happy to work with you to get you some more clarification on those points.
Mr. Chairman, I need some work, especially I'm at Plymouth Ice Arena, to see how that would, because I may introduce a bill on that.
We'll look forward to it.
Yeah, thank you.
I just have one question on the question of if a project has been started and then the unavailability of funding after it started. We do projects in stages from time to time. And would the difference, well, what would the difference be that it, well, what would the difference be?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, you're referring back to the reimbursement question when projects are funded in phases?
Well, sometimes if a project is started, say without funding, state funding, then I understand that you can't get funding in the future for that project. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I think it comes down to more a look at what the facts of the situation are. From a reimbursement standpoint under federal tax law, the state GO bonds could not be used to pay for those project costs. To the extent that matching funds are required by the legislation, those matching funds could pay for prior project costs.
Okay. Any other questions from any members? All right, seeing none, I'll announce that there will be no meeting next week. We'll meet probably a little more regularly, but not next week. And with that, unless there are any other comments, in the words of Sergeant Preston, well, King, this case is closed.